Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a new history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week we're happy to have Edwin Burroughs on the show, and we'll be talking about his new book, Forgotten Patriots, The Untold Story of American Prisoners During the Revolutionary War. Some of you may be familiar with Professor Burroughs' work, as you will have read his terrific Gotham, A History of New York City to 1898. He wrote that book with Mike Wallace, and it won the Pulitzer Prize in History in 1999. Well, I'm happy to say that Professor Burroughs is back with another terrific book, Forgotten Patriots. This book concerns the fate of American and, to some extent, British prisoners of war during the Revolutionary War. It's quite a picture he paints, and it is, as he says in the book, a forgotten story. I didn't know anything about these prisoners of war, and I was very happy to learn about them from such a steady hand as Professor Burroughs. So I really enjoyed talking to him today, and I hope that you enjoy the interview. Here it is. Hi, Ted.
Hi, Marshall. How are you?
I'm very well today. It's a beautiful day here in Iowa. We're having uncharacteristically nice weather. You're in New York, is that right?
Yeah, and it's raining here. So
I'm sorry to hear that. We will send you our sunshine. Let me tell our listeners that we're happy to have Ted Burroughs on the show today, and we'll be talking about his new book, Forgotten Patriots, The Untold Story of American Prisoners During the Revolutionary War. I've read the book, and I think it was absolutely terrific. Ted, you obviously have a gift for writing what is both basically informed history and a very readable history. I've gotten one of those two down. And I would say that's true of most academic historians, but you can serve as a kind of model for us all. And I have to say I was reading passages out loud to my wife saying, why can't I write this sentence?
Oh. Well, I'm flattered.
Well, so it is absolutely true. So why don't you begin by telling us just a little bit about yourself, what the Germans call a Lebenslauf, you know, the course of your life to this point.
Well, actually, though I live in New York, I'm a native of Ann Arbor, Michigan. I was a faculty brat and attended the University of Michigan on a $65 a year scholarship.
Yeah,
those were the good old days.
Yeah, those were the good old days.
Originally started out curiously enough as a physics major, and at some point, midway in my undergraduate career, I took a couple of history courses that I just fell in love with and became a history major by the time I graduated.
Mm-hmm.
Then I went to Columbia in New York, which was my first visit to the big city, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And I became a student of Richard Hofstadter's and Craig McKittrick's at Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly, to the extent that I learned anything about writing at Columbia, I owe a great deal to Richard Hofstadter,
mm-hmm.
as you probably know.
Oh, sure.
Stylist.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I got interested in early American history and wrote a dissertation on a man named Albert Gallatin, who was, among other things, Thomas Jefferson's Treasury Secretary. That book came out in the mid-80s, and I think it sold maybe 10 or 15 copies.
Mm-hmm. I have some like that.
Yeah. Occasionally people read it, and I hear about it. It's cheap footnotes. While I was still a graduate student, I landed a job at Brooklyn College, and this was back in the days when teaching jobs were really pretty scarce.
Mm-hmm.
And entering another period like that. So
mm-hmm.
I began my teaching career at Brooklyn and am still there several decades later. It was at Brooklyn I began teaching courses in early American history, colonial history, the American Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And after a few years of that, I thought it might be fun to try a course on the history of New York City,
mm-hmm.
which I found increasingly interesting and didn't mm-hmm. know a thing about, basically. And my friend and eventual collaborator, Mike Wallace, and I began talking about doing a history of New York City or trying to find things that we could use in class for
mm-hmm.
our students, and realized that there was nothing, in fact, available on the history of New York City that would come up to the standards, anyway, of an undergraduate history course.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing led to another, and eventually we decided to try to write such a book.
Mm-hmm.
We initially envisioned it as a very small book, single volume, that would go from the beginning to the present. What happened, of course, is that once we got started on it, it mushroomed and grew like Pinocchio's nose and consumed years and years of research and reading. And eventually, about maybe 15 years later, after we had both occasionally become distracted by other projects, we produced this large book called Gotham,
mm-hmm.
which takes the story of New York City down only to 1898.
Mm-hmm.
So we got only about halfway along after 15 years of intensive research and reading and writing, and managed to do so in the space of 1,400 pages.
Wow.
Much longer than what we had originally bargained on.
1,400 very readable pages.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
So far, so good.
Yeah.
I won't tell you about all the mistakes that we made along the way. It was actually, it was in the course of doing some of the research for Gotham that I came across this story of the prison ships. And once again, I thought that this would be a great thing to write and teach about. And the more I investigated it, the less I found. And we managed to put together, a pretty decent chapter on the British occupation of New York during the Revolutionary War. But I found it very difficult to find material on the story of these prisons and prison ships. And, and it went down on my list. I was keeping a running list as I went of things to look into once the Gotham project was done.
Mm-hmm.
And a few years ago, well, 4 or 5 years ago, I picked it up again and began digging and poking, and the result is Forgotten Patriots.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What sort of sources did you find on this little-known topic? As you say, I like that expression, the more I looked, the less I found.
This book draws on a variety of things. There are a couple of big sources. A lot of the material, as my fellow historians who know this period will attest, is a lot of it is published, so that there's a pretty good quantity of personal correspondence,
mm-hmm.
As well as official documents that are now available on print and online. So I found that to be very helpful, but I was especially taken by the material that I found in pension applications.
Mm-hmm.
This is a somewhat underused source, I think, by historians.
Mm-hmm.
It originates really in the early 1800s when the federal government finally got around to providing pensions, after considerable debate about this,
mm-hmm.
Providing pensions for Revolutionary War veterans. And the law required them to go to a local court and tell their story. And all
mm-hmm.
of these stories are written down. There's about 80,000 of them.
Wow.
It's an immense oral history of the American Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
Not without its problems, because, of course, many of these men were now in their 60s, 70s, and in some cases 80s when they filed these applications and told their stories.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to be used fairly carefully because memory does play tricks. But the men who had been prisoners of the British, in some cases, left these amazing accounts of what they endured
mm-hmm.
As prisoners of war during the Revolutionary War.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that their testimony was really quite remarkable and moving, actually, and I relied very heavily on that. I also used a lot of newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, now, most American newspapers published in the United States before the 1870s are available online.
Yeah, isn't that terrific?
It's an amazing resource, and I'm absolutely certain that it's going to transform the way we write
mm-hmm.
English American history for
mm-hmm.
sure, because you can do word searches on
mm-hmm.
the names of prison ships or the names
mm-hmm.
of individuals or battles and find
mm-hmm.
information that
mm-hmm.
would have taken in the old days months, weeks, years.
Yeah. I tell my graduate students about the old days and card catalogs and having to look through every edition of Pravda and writing it down. Yeah.
From archive to archive, summer after summer after summer. And I could sit and do research in my pajamas at home.
Yeah.
But, would have taken incredible amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
Probably would have been impossible.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's quite a variety of sources, and the more I dug, into the original sources, the more I realized what a remarkable story this was,
and
just became, at many points, flabbergasted that nobody has really paid very much attention to this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, why don't we ask you? Go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No.
I was going to say, why don't you tell us the story of these prison ships then? How were these men captured, and under what conditions were they held?
Well, Forgotten Patriots is actually not just about the prison ships.
Mm-hmm.
The real focus is on the prisons and prison ships of New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And New York City was the headquarters and nerve center of British operations in North America during the war. And in large part because they didn't effectively control the area around New York City. It was a kind of Gibraltar-like fortress during most of the war.
Mm-hmm.
Most prisoners who were captured either on land or on the high seas were brought back to New York and held for the duration of the conflict, really, or until they expired. And this book is really an attempt to see the revolution from the standpoint of the prisoners, to put the prisoners back in the story, so to speak. So
mm-hmm.
partly about the prison ships, but it's also about many of the land-based prisons.
Mm-hmm.
The conditions in these places were appalling, to say the least. There were at times 4,000, 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 men. The numbers are really difficult to come by. It's all kind of guesswork.
Mm-hmm.
Who were crammed into the holds of broken down warships or into a collection of public buildings actually in the city, churches, sugar houses, private dwellings. They were never fed properly. They very often had to go through winters without adequate firewood. They never had fresh water. And of course, under those kinds of conditions, diseases ran rampant, and my guess is that of the maybe 30,000 or so men who were held in and around New York City during the war, that too is a guesstimate, by the
mm-hmm.
way. I think that maybe 60 and at some points as many as 70% of them perished.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that was of starvation and disease.
Mm-hmm. Now, what was the status of these prisoners under... I guess two sets of laws. One would be the laws of war, rather ill codified, and then the laws of the British Crown.
Prisoners of war in the 18th century were treated more by custom than by law. There was no
mm-hmm.
international law governing the treatment of prisoners. There were jurists and legal scholars who wrote about how prisoners ought to be treated. But those were largely unenforceable suggestions, guidelines
mm-hmm.
that were often honored in the breach more than the observance.
Mm-hmm.
American prisoners, however, didn't fall within even those fairly vague guidelines because they were regarded by the British as rebels and
mm-hmm.
traitors rather than actual prisoners of war.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, until the very end of the war, the British government really refused to recognize captured Americans as prisoners of war because they saw, I think quite correctly, that doing so would, to some degree, acknowledge the legitimacy of Congress. They didn't want Congress. They didn't want to recognize Congress as a
mm-hmm.
as a foreign power.
Mm-hmm.
So American prisoners, whatever rules there were, customs, regulations governing the treatment of prisoners, didn't apply to Americans.
Mm-hmm.
They were regarded as essentially criminals.
Mm-hmm.
Now, also, in 1777, Parliament suspended habeas corpus. To prevent the possibility that anybody would go to court and ask the government to either bring charges against captured Americans or release them.
Mm-hmm.
This was a response particularly to the case of Ethan Allen,
mm-hmm.
who was the first major American to be captured by the British. And he was dragged off to England and thrown in a castle, and then as soon as the possibility that some of his supporters in England would get a writ of habeas corpus, the government hustled him back to the colony so that he could remain a prisoner indefinitely.
Mm-hmm.
Suspending habeas corpus made it possible to hold captured Americans indefinitely without bringing charges, without any kind of no requirements that they be well treated or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, it wasn't really until the very, very end of the war that Parliament rescinded that action and allowed Americans to be treated as prisoners of war. So
mm-hmm.
a good deal of the abuse that Americans were subjected to, I think, stems from the fact that they were in this kind of legal limbo.
Mm-hmm. Now then,
under English law, they were to have been tried for something like, I don't know what the right word to use is, but something like sedition.
Sedition, treason. Rebellion. One of the interesting things that I realized in the course of doing this research is that England had a long history in the 18th century of provincial uprisings of
mm-hmm.
one kind or another. Places like Ireland and Scotland and even Wales were mm-hmm. always in a state of some discontent. And there were occasional outbreaks like the Scottish Uprising in 1745. And British authorities responded to these with what can only be described as severe repression. And that became the kind of model for dealing with trouble on the periphery of the empire.
Mm-hmm.
Send in the army, round up a whole bunch of people, execute them, burn villages, and that'll end the trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And that was largely the way that the British government, beginning of the war, imagined that it would deal with the trouble in the colonies
mm-hmm.
By the use of maximum force and in effect, a kind of brutality that was often referred to in those days as war ad terrorem,
mm-hmm.
that is to say, war to the extremity.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't work. It backfired, as I make clear in the book, by outraging large numbers of Americans and convincing many people like Benjamin Franklin that
mm-hmm.
it was a reason why reconciliation was impossible.
Mm-hmm. Let me go back just for a second to this
sure.
question of habeas corpus, because it's on
mm-hmm.
people's minds these days.
Mm-hmm.
Was the sticking point from the Crown's point of view then that they didn't have the resources to bring all the charges that they needed? Or was it the case that they what was the case? I guess I don't quite understand.
I think the sticking point, yes, I think that was part of it. I think it was also that they did not want to find themselves with this problem in the courts. To litigate this thing would raise the possibility of a jury, a runaway jury deciding
mm-hmm.
that the American cause was legitimate. And this would create all kinds of domestic political problems for
yeah,
the government,
yeah.
which they just didn't want to have to deal with.
So then they really did face a kind of dilemma. In other words, on the one hand, they didn't want to grant
the Americans the status of prisoners of war because that was legitimate in some sense their cause. On the other hand, they didn't want to litigate all of these cases, or they could not litigate all these cases. Yeah,
right. Because the perception was, the governing perception, I think, was that this was essentially a military problem,
mm-hmm.
And that if it got turned into a political problem, it would be unsolvable.
Mm-hmm. So did
the fact turn out badly?
Did constitutional scholars or lawyers or jurists or those funny folks in wigs say that this was a rather odd thing to do, and these Americans were in a kind of legal limbo that was contra English legal principles?
Well, there was a little bit of debate about this when Parliament passed the act suspending habeas corpus. There were a handful of people in Parliament who stood up and said, this is unconscionable and wrong and so forth. And Lord North, who was the nominal head of the government, made a nice little speech saying that, these are difficult times, and we have a problem on our hands that has to be dealt with sternly. decides they're not going to do anything domestically that will that should alarm you. This is only something that is a response to the immediate crisis in the colony.
Mm-hmm.
And there was such a wave of anti-American feeling, in not only in Parliament but in the country as a whole, in the early stages of the war, anyway, that very few people really objected to this.
Mm-hmm. So, did the American authorities themselves, that is, the proto-Congress and Washington and his staff, did they protest against the treatment of American prisoners in New York?
All the time, over and over again, constantly, and threatened frequently to retaliate against British prisoners that they got their hands on. But they never really did. There are a few examples that I cite in the book where some prisoners were, officers in particular, were put under lock and key for a while, by way of sending a message to the British. But by and large, Congress, and especially Washington, just didn't have the stomach to retaliate on British prisoners. So they were pretty much forced to settle for loud and lengthy protests for the duration of the war.
So did they use this as a propaganda tool?
Oh, very much. I mean, that's where, in fact, the use of newspapers is particularly revealing. This was talked about all the time. Congress conducted several different investigations in the course of the war, producing affidavits and other documents about the experiences of prisoners in New York and elsewhere. But it was also something that really electrified American public opinion. As soon as the first stories began to get out, there was just a wave of reaction in the colonies. And I think that these stories, as they circulated, as some prisoners would be occasionally released and they would come back home, or they would tell their stories in private letters or in newspaper interviews, it caused a real backlash, and that many Americans who I think might have been straddling the fence in the early stages of the war became committed patriots as these stories began to circulate.
What did the British say against these charges? How did they try to defend themselves? Did they answer them at all?
Frequently. Almost not at all. That's one of the more interesting things about this, is that British commanders like General Howe, General Clinton, even Cornwallis in the later stages of the war, they knew that this was a public relations nightmare, that they had really ignited this firestorm of hostility to the British, that they were losing, as a result of this, the war for the hearts and minds of the American population.
Mm-hmm.
But they really didn't come up with any kind of systematic response. Not during the war, and certainly not after the war. There were one or two occasions when some kind of mid-range British officials in New York would try to, you know, put together something of a response to this. I tell the story of one or two occasions where they would try to get together their own depositions and their own statements from officials that Americans were not being mistreated, but they were so patently contrived that nobody, I think, could take them seriously.
Mm-hmm. Why? I guess this may sound like a silly question, but why didn't the British take these American prisoners and impress them into the Royal Navy and send them to the other side of the world?
Well, you know, there's a theory that, I think there's some truth in this, at least at points in the story, that one of the reasons for at least stinting on provisions for prisoners was that they would get hungry and desperate enough that they would, in fact, enlist in the Navy.
Uh-huh.
That's one of the things that distinguishes the present circumstances that the United States faces in, say, Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah.
With the situation during the Revolutionary War, nobody ever argued that mistreating prisoners in Iraq or Afghanistan was designed to enlist, find enlistment for the army. there's some reason to think that in the Revolutionary War that was done, and indeed it worked occasionally. There are reports that not many, but some certainly over the years, some prisoners did indeed enlist. Those stories also suggest, however, that the men who enlisted would very often enlist, go have a nice meal, do a brief tour of duty, and then escape and go back to the American side. So I don't think that it happened very often, and if it was a recruiting tool, it wasn't terribly successful.
Maybe we could talk a little bit about these prison ships, which I found fascinating. And
I should tell our listeners that there are some terrific reproductions of, I guess, their 19th century prints of the prison ships, and they do indeed look incredibly terrifying and spooky. Can you tell us about the history of prison ships in general and how these particular ships were outfitted in order to be prison ships? Because they, until you see the plates, you don't really realize that they are ships in sort of name only.
Right, stripped of every usable piece of equipment reduced to hulks. In fact, this was often described at the time as hulking the ship. And then in the case of New York, they would be anchored most often in Wallabout Bay, which is a little cove on the Brooklyn side of the East River. The British had used prison ships, as far as I can tell, a little bit in the past for Scottish prisoners captured in the uprising in 1745, and they had been used to a certain extent during the French and Indian War, the Seven Years' War. But they had never been used quite so extensively as they would be during the American Revolution. There were probably anywhere from 15 to 20 prison ships or hospital ships, which were much different from the prison ships that were used in the course of the war to house American prisoners. And what I found particularly interesting was that at the same time the British were making the decision to use prison ships were also being used in England in response to the trouble in the colonies. And what had happened is that English courts were in the habit, as we know, of sentencing convicted felons to transportation to the colonies. But when the troubles in America started, transportation was no longer a feasible alternative. So the prison population of England began to grow quite sharply, and the surplus was stored on prison ships that were anchored in the Thames around the same time that the American Revolutionary War was starting. So the decision to use prison ships in the colonies was really the flip side of a decision to use prison ships back in England itself. And all of these places were just known to be dreadful beyond description. There were many reformers actually in England who began to attack the use of prison ships very early, and there were kind of steady series of reports during the Revolutionary War that prison ships were terrible. But those criticisms were never directed at the prison ships in America that were being used to confine American prisoners. So the double standard that was being applied there.
Yeah, I just found it
very interesting that they would take what was about to be a decommissioned ship, and tell me if I'm wrong here, they would sail it over to America, strip it of basically all of its naval wares, and then outfit it for prisoners. That was the basic plan,
wasn't it?
That was the basic plan, and it actually made a certain kind of sense because the British didn't have anywhere else to put these people.
Right.
And if you were to anchor one of these prison ships in a place like Wallabout Bay, you'd be out in the center of this broad area of shallow water and mud flats and so forth, which would make escape very difficult. It was clearly understood at the time that large numbers of men confined in close quarters with very poor sanitation and nutrition would be subject to contagious diseases, and it was thought a good idea to move these prison ships to a place that was in those days outside of New York City. So a lot of things made the idea of a prison ship anchored somewhat away from the city itself seem like a pretty smart response to this problem, because the British were capturing large numbers of Americans. They didn't really have an immediately good means of dealing with them.
Yeah, one of the things I think that I don't remember whether you mentioned this in the book or not, but they also served as kind of a living example to the residents in the area of what would happen in the case of because there they were. I mean, really, I have to say again, these prints are they're positively almost gothic.
Yeah,
they're so scary.
Yeah,
it's true, but everybody could see them there from Brooklyn and from...
Exactly.
Yeah, right, exactly. And there they were.
In fact, you couldn't only see them, but there are some reports that you could smell them.
Yeah.
It was in the wrong direction. It must have been horrible.
Also, what did they...
Now, again, I know the answer to this question, but I'd like to hear you tell our listeners about it. What did they do with them after the war? I found that fascinating.
Well, I tried to figure that out in some cases. A few of them were actually sold off for scrap. I found a few newspaper advertisements from the weeks and months after the British abandoned the city, indicating that some of these ships had been effectively broken up and pieces sold off at auction. The big ship, the one that everybody ended up, I think, talking about more than any other was the Jersey. This was a 64-gun frigate that was one of the biggest ships in the harbor. It's about 150 feet long and 40 or so feet wide. Normally carried a crew of around 400, give or take, and at various points had something like 1,100 or 1,200 prisoners, several times its normal component at crewmen. So conditions were just dreadful. People were packed in there like sardines, and they were oftentimes people who would live to tell the story would speak of bodies that would lie for days before they were discovered. Absolutely dreadful. And those places, those ships were so pestilential that after the war, the Jersey basically disintegrated because nobody wanted to go near it. It was anchored out in Rollabout Bay, and for maybe 10 or 15 years after the war, it just slowly broke up and sank into the mud. There were some places where souvenir hunters, would go and cut the timbers or pieces of wood from some of these prisons, but nobody did that with the Jersey because it was considered so dangerous, and so it just fell apart.
Yeah, I just find that kind of spooky and, in a weird way, romantic, that hulk would just sit out there in Rollabout Bay for 10 or 15 years in sort of ruins, it was sort of a symbol of British power in North America. There it is crumbling, and also the cruelty of man to man. I just, the image of it is
after the war, when Congress took up residence in New York, congressmen would go over to the Brooklyn side of the East River and stand on the hill where Fort Greene Park now stands and look out over Rollabout Bay. There was the Jersey breaking up very slowly out in the mud.
Yeah. So then you deal with the question of what to do with two things, really. One is the physical remains of the people that had died, and the British had quickly interred them there on the Brooklyn side, I guess. And then there was the question of memorializing these people, which you deal with in a really fascinating way. Maybe you could talk a little bit about the first of those, and then we could come to the second. What did they do to the remains that obviously were improperly buried?
Well, toward the very end of the war, there were some reports that went out trying to kind of gauge the number of Americans who had lost their lives, particularly on the prison ships. And for various reasons, the number 11,644 became a kind of accepted number. And I think probably that's fairly accurate. It can be corroborated from a couple of other sources. And there was also a discussion, as those numbers began to circulate around the colonies, there was a discussion of whether something shouldn't be done to memorialize, to commemorate the death of so many Americans, which, remember, was probably 2 to 3 times the number who died in combat. So, mm-hmm. as I say in the book, more Americans lost their lives for independence in places like Wallabout Bay than they did fighting in battles up and down the United States.
Mm-hmm.
But this business of putting up a monument was very controversial. It's really interesting to see how Americans in the post-war period handled this question. I mean, we tend to think fairly without much discussion that when something really horrible like this happened, that one of our first responses was to build a memorial.
Yeah, it's very interesting because I was just reading an article about this. We put monuments up for things that didn't happen in the United States and had no bearing on American history.
Put up a memorial, hang a wreath, do something that will sort of remind us and subsequent generations of what had taken place. But in the 1780s and 1790s, there was also this sense that statues and obelisks and, urns and memorials of one kind or another were un-Republican,
mm-hmm.
that the United States was making a clean break with this aristocratic, monarchical Europe, and that those were the kinds of things that European monarchs would do, and that we American Republicans should remember and honor the sacrifices of these prison ship martyrs, as they were very frequently known at the time, by writing books and poetry and song, art, and so forth, not in monuments, which were considered to be un-Republican and inappropriate for the United States. So it was. It took a long time, really, before the idea of commemorating anything that happened in the Revolution began to get any sort of traction. And there are actually relatively few Revolutionary-era memorials in the United States. The Bunker Hill Memorial, for example, if memory serves, which it may not, dates from the 1830s sometime. I mean, it was many, many decades after the war before a lot of Americans began thinking that maybe the time had come to do something to memorialize the war dead. And over the years, there were a number of civic organizations, political organizations, Tammany Hall being the most important of them, who would periodically beat the drums for some kind of a memorial to be built to commemorate the prison ship martyrs.
Mm-hmm.
But nothing much ever really came of it. I talk about a number of events in the early 1800s when Tammany Hall organized these monstrous parades and rallies and so forth, and they would collect bones from the beaches of Wallabout, and they would deposit them in urns, and there would be great orations, and money would be collected and so forth. And
mm-hmm.
then 6 months later, it would all be forgotten. And nothing, nothing ever happened, really, until the later decades of the 19th century. I mean, I'm compressing a complicated story. It really wasn't until a number of national organizations, one of which turns out to be the DAR, which had a lot of clout, sort of fixed on this topic and began to pressure Congress for a substantial grant of money to put up a monument.
Mm-hmm.
And that monument wasn't completed until 1908, which is well over 100 years after the end of the Revolutionary War.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a testimony to how difficult it is, even in the 20th century, to construct these memorials at public expense.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned it's a very good point you make, because I know I lived in D.C. for 5 or 6 years, and I remember asking a friend of mine why there wasn't a huge memorial in D.C. to the Civil War, and my friend looked at me and he said, "Have you been to the mall? The entire thing is a memorial to the Civil War." But, there is the Washington Monument there, but that wasn't started until quite a bit later, as I understand it.
No, it wasn't even finished until after the Civil War.
Yeah, exactly. And so, the memory of – and every little town in New England and also in the Midwest has its Civil War memorial. They're all over Iowa here, but there's no real memory of the Revolutionary conflict at all. And I would think, particularly in the in the context of the New York area, where the built environment is very thick, that it must be extraordinarily difficult to even carve out, you know, 20 square meters to do anything. I mean, you can see what's going on today with the World Trade Center monument. That story has gone on so long that I think Americans have lost interest. I have no idea what's going on with that. But
yeah, the politics are ferocious, and the politicking over even a simple memorial to the Revolutionary War dead was pretty incredible as well.
So just for the purpose of the many listeners who are in the New York area now, and for those that visit it, what are there existing memorials to the prisoners in the New York area?
There are two. There is still the Prison Ship Martyrs Memorial in Fort Greene Park in Brooklyn, which is just on a hill overlooking Walbaum Bay, just about to celebrate its 100th anniversary. But badly neglected and largely forgotten for the last couple of generations. I mean, that's another part of the story. The monument went up, and then everybody went home, and that was that was the end of it. There is a second very small monument in the churchyard of Trinity Church in Lower Manhattan on Broadway, which was put up in the 1850s. To commemorate the men who died in a nearby sugar house, one of the most infamous prisons during the Revolutionary War. I tell the story about the construction of that monument, and that, too, was political, because, in fact, there's some reason to think that Trinity Church actually put it up to prevent the city from running a street through its the motivation was less one of honoring the worthy dead than it was protecting their real estate interests. But those are the only two, and you're quite right that one of the reasons why it's so hard for people who live in or even visit New York to get a handle on this is that there's nothing left. It's all gone.
Yeah, I was going to mention that. I wanted you to talk about that a little bit, because one of the most fascinating parts of the book is the occasional aside where you attempt to locate something that happened in the contemporary Brooklyn or Manhattan landscape, and you just can't, because literally everything is gone. And it got me thinking, here in Iowa City, I live in a house that's 100 years old, surrounded by houses that are somewhere between 150 and 100 years old. Downtown, there are many buildings that say, 1860, 1850. None of that really survives
And New York City, remember, was founded in the 1620s.
Yeah, exactly.
And there is not a single building, with one exception, standing in modern New York City that was constructed before the American Revolution.
That's astounding.
In other words, 150 years of the city's history has essentially been obliterated.
Yeah.
The exception that I have in mind, of course, is St. Paul's Chapel, which is on Lower Broadway, just below City Hall Park. You could argue about the Morris Juno Mansion way, way in Upper Manhattan, but that was outside the city at the time of the Revolution. So it's all gone. It's all very new. It's all really late 20th century built environment, and the same thing is really true over in Brooklyn. It's really hard to remember that the biggest battle of the Revolutionary War was fought in Brooklyn. Brooklyn, and you can wander around for years and not find anything that connects to that story. Quite astonishing.
Yeah, I find that kind of astounding in a sense, because I grew up in the Midwest and actually in Kansas, and I remember kind of having the sense that the things that I thought were old weren't really very old. But then, I spent some time on the East Coast, and I realized that everything there was newer than the things that I saw.
But remember that there are places like Philadelphia and Boston where you can go and see stuff that's really quite ancient by American standards.
Yeah,
you can go visit Paul Revere's house in Boston, or you can go see, Carpenter's Hall in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
Different cities have different sort of municipal cultures, and New York is a place that, as I often say to audiences, is quite historicidal when you compare it with other major American cities.
Oh, I think that's absolutely right. Yeah, I did live in Boston, and they've done a nice job of preserving much of it. And so in Philadelphia, especially Philadelphia, I would say, but New York, it really is.
It really is incredible how much the physical environment has changed and changes all the time. I would like to see a time lapse film of New York for the last 300 years, because
that's why people come to New York, after all.
Yeah.
People come to New York to escape the past, not to find it. It's the secret of New York's continuing appeal. It's not connected to the, held down by the dead hand of tradition.
Yeah, no.
But it's all over Boston and Philadelphia.
Yeah, that makes your job a little bit more difficult. But it's a very interesting place to live. I did live in New York for a year, my time, it was very enjoyable. I really liked it a lot. Let me ask you not a concluding question, but a question I'm sure everybody is interested in, and that is, what impact did the horrible treatment of American prisoners during the Revolutionary War have on American attitudes toward the treatment of prisoners of war more generally after the war, if any?
Well, that's a bigger question than I really deal with in the book. I make a couple of suggestions about it. In the aftermath, in the immediate aftermath of the war, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams were told by Congress to go out and start arranging, negotiating treaties with European powers. And one of the things that they attempted to do in these treaties was to create specific provisions for the correct treatment of prisoners of war. And I mentioned this toward the end of the book, as testimony to the concern that Americans had about the mistreatment of prisoners, and that it was in Franklin's mind particularly extremely important that the United States take steps to prevent such things from happening again in the future. And I think that Franklin had a very keen sense that the United States needed to be on record as opposing the mistreatment of prisoners and preventing something from happening to Americans or anyone else that would happen to Americans during the Revolutionary War. It's a long way, obviously, from some of those very early treaties to the Geneva Accords in the early 20th century. But I do think that the experience of the Revolutionary War convinced many Americans that the country should do what it could to prevent that sort of thing from happening in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously that hasn't always worked that way, and there are certainly occasions during the Revolutionary War itself when it was pretty clear that Americans were just as capable as the British were of mistreating prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
But I was just struck by this sense that what Americans had experienced as prisoners of the British had somehow changed the way that they thought about the future, and that the country should be committed to some kinds of humanitarian principles which would set it apart from other countries in the world.
Mm-hmm. Now, then, after the war was concluded, just to kind of finish up the story, after the war was concluded and all these prisoners were released, that is, those who had been lucky enough to survive, were they honored in any particular way by the government, or were they given pensions? You mentioned pensions.
No, they just disappeared. I mean, the government. There were no marching bands, no welcoming committees, no laurel wreaths and that sort of thing. These guys just the gates were opened up. They were not all released at once. There was a kind of process by which they were set free in the early months of 1783.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time the British left in November of 1783, most of them were gone, and they just kind of they straggled home.
Mm-hmm.
There was not much interest in providing them with pensions because the feeling was that military service was something that you did as part of your civic duties. It was like voting, if you will, and that we don't compensate people for voting. We don't reward them for doing their civic duty.
Mm-hmm.
So why should the country reward veterans? there were some exceptions that were made for veterans who had been wounded, but regular veterans, there was no sense that military service entitled you to, you know, to get in line and get a pension from the government,
mm-hmm.
because that was the sort of thing that was simply required. It was your duty as a citizen.
Cincinnatus, back to the plow.
Yeah,
exactly. But then that changed. You said that if I heard you correctly, you said that a number of decades later that it was decided to actually give them pensions.
Yeah, there was growing pressure, particularly in the years around during the run up to the War of 1812, for a variety of reasons. There was a growing sentiment in the country that something should be done to compensate and recognize the sacrifices of veterans. And slowly but surely, legislation was adopted. There was some in the 18-teens and there was some in the 1820s. And finally, it wasn't until really the 1830s that Congress really decided to grant pensions to all Revolutionary War veterans if they could prove that they, in fact, had served. By which time, you know, large numbers of them had already gone to their reward. So
yeah.
it was a complicated and tortured process.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's very interesting how that
notion of republicanism, that Cincinnatus back to the plow notion, is I won't say it's completely lost. I mean, we have a memory of it, but it has now fallen into abeyance, I would say, or some sort of...
It's attenuated.
Yeah, it's attenuated. Yeah, it's not really... We have a very different attitude about these things today. I mean, we've just gone through Veterans Day, which is an entire, a holiday to celebrate the services of these people. So, yeah, it has changed quite a bit, and it's very interesting. Yeah. So, well, Ted, thank you very much. We've taken up a lot of your time, and it's a terrific book. I want to say that. And I want to close with what is our traditional question on New Books in History, and that is, what are you working on now?
Well, I've got a couple of things that I am looking at. No decisions have been made yet. One of them that I'm interested in is and I don't know whether there's a book in this or not. It's just something that I've been intrigued by. There was a massive volcanic explosion in 1815. Mount Tambor blew up and created such a cloud of ash and sulfuric acid that it essentially prevented North America from having a summer in the year 1816.
It's really?
In fact, known as the year without a summer.
Hmm.
It was snowing in New England in June, July. This event, so far as I can determine, has never received the attention that I think it might receive, obviously from people who are climatically sensitized as we are.
Well, I'm more ignorant than most, but I have never heard of it, so
yeah,
that's an encouraging note.
I think it would be a really interesting thing to look into in terms of the cultural and economic consequences of something like this.
Mm-hmm.
But as I say, I've just been thinking about it, and I really don't know if there's much more to be said about it.
Mm-hmm. And then the second?
The second one is I've long been fascinated by a building in New York City called the Crystal Palace, which was the largest building of its time in the United States. It was built in the early 1850s and was on the site of what is now Bryant Park, just behind the Public Library.
Oh, yeah.
In New York. It was a kind of a scaled-down version of the Crystal Palace in England, in London.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the first great public exhibition of American art and industry in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So that it was the biggest building, and it was the first time that Americans had showcased all of the products of the Industrial Revolution. And it drew thousands of people to New York who came and saw and stayed over in hotels and restaurants. It was really the beginning, in a sense, of New York as a kind of tourist destination in the United States.
Yeah, here, it's another one of these cases where it does not survive. I mean, if you've been to Bryant Park, there's nothing there.
Burned to the ground. That
is that is a typical New York story, though.
Typical New York story.
Here today, gone.
And it has the benefit of a relatively short lifespan.
Yeah.
And it also is a subject that historians have neglected because it's as I say, it's the beginning, in a sense, of this whole tradition of world fairs.
Mm-hmm.
So it has a lot of appeal as a kind of moment in the cultural history of the United States. But again, whether there's more to be said about it, I just don't know. I'm keeping an open mind.
Well, they both sound like terrific projects to me. And whichever one you complete first, and I'm sure you'll complete both, please get in touch, and we'll have you back on the show again to talk about those. Yeah, no, it was great talking to you today. We really appreciate you being on the show. The book is Forgotten Patriots, The Untold Story of American Prisoners During the Revolutionary War. Ted Burroughs, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you, Marshall. It was a pleasure.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Edwin Burroughs about his new book, Forgotten Patriots, The Untold Story of American Prisoners During the Revolutionary War. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a great week.